WIBC. Dave Wilson here along with Donald Davidson. We're in studio on My Name Is Circle. Donald and Scott Johnston are out at Ron Himmelgarn's garage. Donald, good morning. Good afternoon, actually.
It's cold out here.
Yeah. Are the guys working on Buddy Lazier's number 91, Delara?
No, they went home. It's too cold. The last one to leave was Buddy, though, interestingly enough.
Really?
Yeah, yesterday and today.
Well, find some shop rags, set them on fire, and huddle around it. That's our advice. Let's get to the phones. We got a call all the way down to Austin, Texas. Mike, you're on WIBC with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Hi, Mike. I'm fine. Thank
you.
How are you?
Got a question about Tony Homan, but also wanted to follow up a comment regarding one question last week about the Jewish drivers. I think Peter Revson, Steve Krizloff, and assuming Thomas Schechter starts the race, that would be three that I know of.
Well, I wouldn't argue with any of those.
Okay.
I didn't know about Schechter, but I thought that. But
yeah,
I didn't want to say anything unless that's been published somewhere, but there have been others.
Yeah, I have a book at home, Great Jewish Athletes, and Jody Schechter's in there. So.
Really? Well, you know what? I didn't know about that, but I remember that 25 years ago, almost 30 years ago, I thought that.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. So, but there are others.
Yep. My comment or my question is regarding Tony Homan, two-part. Number one, it seemed like Tony Homan and A.J. Foyt had a very special relationship.
Yes.
And I remember when Foyt won in 77, he offered Tony Homan a ride in a pace car, which I'd never seen before.
Yes.
So that's my first question is, what was the genesis of that relationship? And then my second question is, what is your favorite Tony Homan story? Because I've heard so many good things about
him. My favorite Tony Homan story. That relationship with Foyt was very special, and actually went back before he even drove in the 500 for the first time. It came about, as far as I know, that was through Elmer George and Mary, and running the Tangerine Midget Tournament for USAC Midgets in Florida in February and March of 1957. As far as I know, that's where that started.
Wow.
And then they just became very, very good friends and, traveled together and got to know Tony through that way. And I remember that Foyt said that he would be invited down to their yacht and they had all the waiters and very nice dinners and everything, and how awkward that he kind of felt with all this attention that he was getting. And so it's almost, he was almost like a son to Tony.
Yeah, that was...
My favorite story is, there was quite a few that we gathered when there was a piece we did in the program a few years ago about the Homan family, and what I wanted to do was to get anecdotes from people, and there was actually two, and I'll just try and buzz through these. One was Mario's favorite was, or an example of how generous and shy and caring that Tony Homan was. In 1966, USAC had a race in Mount Fuji, Japan, where they took down 33 Indianapolis 500 cars and drivers to run a race down there. And on the way down, the cars went on one flight and the personnel went on another. And Mario said that poor Tony, everybody wanted to talk to him. And he was sort of like a captive audience. And he said this one point, he was coming down the aisle and he had a sandwich in one hand. And he was going to go back and sit down and eat this sandwich. And this fellow got up from his seat in the aisle and wanted to talk to Tony, held out his hand to shake hands. And poor Tony didn't know what to do with the sandwich, so he put it in his pocket.
Oh.
And evidently the thing must have had mayonnaise. And he used to wear these sort of khaki-colored suits. And Mario said after a while you could see this brown circle starting to appear through the pocket. Then another one was Tom Sneva hadn't been around very long, and he was out playing golf one afternoon. And he was on, I don't know the holes of the course the way they were exactly by number, but it was over close to the VIP suites on turn two. And so he said he took a slice, and this thing went flying up in the air and arced over. And there was quite a nice-looking car was coming along, and the ball smashed through one of the windows. And somebody said, "Oh, no, that's Tony Holman's car." And Tom thought, "Well, I'm not going over there." So anyway, apparently this friend of his went over there, and here was Tony Holman sitting in the car with a shower of broken glass all around him, and he handed the ball at the broken window. But just a very shy, and he just wanted people to enjoy themselves, and he was just so polite and just a delightful person. There was only ever one of him.
Yeah, that's for sure. Mike, thanks for your call. We do appreciate it. 618, we'll come right back. Chris, hang on. And then your calls at 239-1070. Right now, let's take a look at sky traffic. Here's Big John Gillis. 622, talking Gasoline Alley. Donald Davidson, Dave Wilson. Donald back at Himmelgarn's Garage. Our thanks for their Friday support this year. Coors Light and Delta Faucet. 7 o'clock tonight, Robbie Buell on Sports Talk with Kevin Lee. Let's go to the phones down in Martinsville. We'll speak with Chris. Hi, Chris. You're on WIBC with Donald Davidson.
Hey, King and Donald.
Hi, Chris.
How y'all doing?
Just fine, thanks.
Good. I just one little thing before my questions. When I was real young, like 74, 75, I shook hands with Mr. Holman. He exuded kindness.
Uh-huh, yes. That's a perfect word, kindness.
Ed Crombie, he drove a car they used to make fun of. It was the Zombie, maybe. And Davey Hamilton's dad had a weird car like in 82. I love asking questions about oddball cars.
Boy, you know your stuff. Ed Crombie was a Canadian. And he was there in 76 and 77. Can't remember what the car was called now, the Spirit of something. I need to go back and...
Was it an old Eagle, maybe?
I'm sorry?
Was it an old Eagle?
Yes, it was. The Ken Hamilton, Davey Hamilton's dad, he was... the car that he had was called the Eagle Aircraft Flyer. His years, actually, he was there twice... 81 and 82, and in 81 it was a regular Eagle, but with a stock block Chevy engine, and he wasn't too far off of qualifying with that, but the Eagle Aircraft Flyer was a thing that he and a couple of friends built themselves, and it was a really strange looking vehicle, and it ran in practice, but they never went to the qualifying line, and it was... few years went by, that was 1982 was the year, few years went by, and then Davey Hamilton started to show up, and he became very good friends with Ron Hamilgarn, and I remember the discussion, because I asked Davey about that, and he said, yeah, we've still got that car, because the father lives in Boise, Idaho. He said, as a matter of fact, it's outside of a barn with a tarp over it. They didn't even have it inside. And so Ron Hamilgarn, who had taken Davey under his wing, and I don't know how this all came about, but Ron knew about the car. He remembered it, and he said, yeah, I got to have that. And he now owns it. I'm not sure where it is, but he has that car.
I saw it one day at the shop over there off of Gasoline Alley.
Oh, just recently?
Last year or two.
Okay, then. Yeah, I haven't been out to see it, but I did know it was probably, about maybe 3-4 years ago that he got it.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, thanks for the call. Nice call. Let's continue on. We'll speak with Corey in Muncie. Hi, Corey. How are you?
Hi, Dave. Hi, Donald. And how are you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
I'm good. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question. When I was a kid, I think it was in 1986, Sammy Swindell, I was running, I think, CART. My dad and I went to go up to Michigan International Speedway when they had the tire problem up there and they had to cancel the race.
Yes.
And I was wondering, did he try to qualify for the 500 that
year? No. It was 87 is when he tried to qualify for the 500. And he drove a car that had a stock block Pontiac.
Okay.
And John Butera, who's actually here, he comes every year, and I've seen him the last several days. John Butera put that together. He was a famous engine builder and hot rodder. And they hired Sammy Swindell to qualify the car, and he qualified and got bumped, and he was the first alternate starter, and that really was kind of a hurt. We'd like to have seen that one in the race, and he just missed it by a fraction. Well, one position, but not that far off on speed, and I think it would have added a lot to have that car in the race, but obviously those were the days of the pop-off valves on the turbochargers, and this was normally aspirated, so... You know, all he could do was just flat-footed all the way around.
Well, I just thought it was amazing that he was the only one out there racing with that engine. And yeah. I remember the sound was so much different from the rest of the car.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And
as a matter of fact, I think that was the that was just about the last true stock block without a turbocharger at the track. Dale Coyne was there in 88 and 89, but just ran in practice a little bit. But Sammy Swindell may have been, I shouldn't say these things because I regret it later, he probably was the last person to make a qualifying attempt with a normally aspirated true stock block.
Yeah. That's, thank you for the information.
Okay.
Thank you, Corey. We appreciate the call. It is 627. We'll come right back. Hang on out there, guys. Stay warm out there, Donald.
Okay.
Run in place.
Actually, of course, what we're running is normally aspirated true stock blocks now, so I withdraw that statement.
There you go. Steve Claremont, hang on. John Glennon and your calls. Talk of Gasoline Alley continues after noon. All right, thanks, Joe. 634, Talk of Gasoline Alley. Donald Davidson back at the Gasoline Alley in the Ron Hemmelgarn Garage along with Scott Johnston. And our thanks also to Jonathan Burr, who from years gave us shelter at the Speedway. And plenty of substance, too. Claremont, Indiana. Steve, you're up on WIBC with Donald.
Hey, Donald. Hey, King. Oh. How you guys doing?
Good. Fine, sir.
Donald, got a question for you. I enjoyed your comments last night on the analogy of the Ford and the Meyer-Drake Offenhauser engine. What about the Drake V8? What
yes.
can you tell us about that? I know it was a short-lived project.
Yeah, in fact, that kind of ended the line and put the company out of business. They thought that they needed to do something to keep up with Ford, because what you had with the Offie, you had the Offie forever, then the Ford came in with the pushrod engine in 63, and then double overhead camshaft in 64. In retaliation, then Ford or Offie had supercharged on and off for a period of years, but in 66 they had their first turbocharger, and it took a little while to get that thing going, but by 68 that was pretty much the engine that you had to have. So then Ford, they turbocharged. And so then after a few years, Drake Engineering felt that they needed to do something. So a V8 Offie had been talked about for years, and I think it was 78. I'm trying to think of the first one I remember. There was a few of them, not very many. 78, but I don't think there was any in the race. 79, I'm pretty sure that there was. I think Johnny Parsons drove for Lindsey Hopkins and had a V8 Drake Engineering. There was a couple of others as well, but they were not very successful. And then I think by 80, that was just about the end of the company.
Okay.
There still is a Drake Engineering, but I think that they just do machine work or something. I'm not sure. John Drake, who is Dale Drake's son, runs the company, but I don't think they produced an engine after about 80. And as a matter of fact, I do know that there were several teams that had them, and I don't understand a lot of business practices, but there were people that wanted to buy them, and they were waiting. They would hold on to them because there was a 7-year depreciation or something like that, I think.
Yeah.
And so finally it was 86 or 87, then they started selling them off to the collectors that wanted them.
Okay, very good. Well, I remember Johnny Parsons was the only person I could remember that really had any success with them. And if I remember, they had trouble with the belt drives on the overhead cams. They were always having breakage problems with those. So.
That could be. I'm not a gearhead. It seemed to me that there was two or three in the race, but Parsons in 79 is the only one that I can think of, and he was an early out.
Well, Donald, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Enjoy it. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Let's head to the north side and talk to John. John, you're on WIBC with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Donald.
How are you, sir?
I'm just fine, thank you. Enjoy your show. Enjoy listening to you every night.
Well, thank you.
I just want to ask you real quick, why have they gone to 3 days of qualifying instead of four, just in case it rains Sunday? You'd still have Saturday and Sunday. For years it was Saturday, Sunday, Saturday, and Sunday. And why have they cut this Saturday out?
Well, actually they've given it back. For a couple of years they went to one weekend only. It was Saturday, Sunday on 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was last year that they decided to go back to something similar to what they had had. And whether they will ever go back to the four, I don't know. But they did, in retrospect, think, you know what, that second weekend was a pretty good thing. But in the past, when you had the four-day format, very often the second Sunday, not much would happen. And that would normally be the quietest of the 4 days if weather was okay. And it just, they tried to do it in one weekend, and some car owners thought it was great. And I thought, well, you know, some of the owners that made that comment hadn't been around a while, and I thought, you haven't been around long enough to get sophomore car owner blues yet and find out that things don't always work out.
Yeah.
And if you have got a good program going, and then you have major problem on Saturday, and you can't get it together by Sunday, we don't do no provisionals around here.
Yep.
And so I like the idea of having like a second chance after you've had a chance to regroup. And so, you know, 4 days would be fine with me, or I have had a couple of other ideas if it was me, but it isn't me. And having a Sunday on the following week is fine with me, because I do like that midweek opportunity for other operations to come together and people that had a problem on the first weekend to regroup.
All right. Thanks, Donald. 640. And thank you, John. We appreciate the call. We'll come right back. We've got lots more calls. Put room for more. 239-1070. The talk of Gasoline Alley continues on WIBC after this. 6:43, the talk at Gasoline Alley. Donald Davidson, Dave Wilson back with you. 7 o'clock tonight, Sports Talk, Kevin Lee. We'll have the gentleman who will start in the middle of row number one, Robbie Buell, as his special guest. Let's go to the north side and speak with Glenn. Glenn, you're on WIBC with Donald Davidson.
Hello, I enjoy your program.
You.
I was at the track. I was on the first turn when Tom Sneva came down. I don't know what the speed was. Tom Carnegie said he broke the record. And what is Tom Sneva doing today?
Oh, I think you're probably talking about 1977.
Yeah, about
when his first and second laps were over the first over 200 miles an hour. Oh. Is probably what you're talking about.
Yeah, it was over 200.
Yeah.
What's Tom doing today?
Well, he has a golf course on the north side of Phoenix. I don't know if he plans to come this year. He has been about every year, but I haven't heard whether he plans on even coming in this time. He likes to make appearances and be reimbursed for the appearances, and if it wasn't for that, I don't know if he would come anyway or not. He does show up here at odd times, or I'll rephrase that. You see him at times when you wouldn't expect it, sometimes in the dead of winter, so he's in and out of town quite a bit.
I know his brother Jerry's looking for work.
Yes, he is indeed. Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, thanks for the call. We do appreciate that. Let's move now down, and we'll speak with Jim on his cell phone down on the south side. You're on WIBC, Jim.
Good evening.
Hello, Jim.
Yes. Donald, before I ask my question, just want to point out, in addition to Tony Holman, there's one other very kind and generous person at the Speedway that's there today, and that's you, Donald. A couple of years ago, you granted my daughter an interview on Scott Braden, and you were very generous, and you're a very kind person. So,
thank you.
That's something that a lot of people don't realize, how kind and generous you are.
Thank you very much.
So we very much appreciate your doing that.
Oh, well, I enjoy talking to the kids that are interested. So,
right.
Thank you.
So I was hoping that maybe you would talk and expound a little bit on Scott Brayton's career. And kind of attached to that, when I watched an interview with Robbie Buell last night, I was kind of taken back by how much like Scott he is, and how much he reminds me of Scott, and so maybe compare and contrast those two a little bit, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, don't hang up yet.
Okay.
If you didn't know this, I'm going to floor you. Did you know that Robbie Buell is married to Scott's widow?
Becky, yes. In fact, when Robbie had the accident and with the head injury, the first thing I thought of was, my God, what's Becky going through?
Yes, okay then. I didn't know if you were aware of that. Of Scott's career, he had a long one at the Speedway. 1981 is the first year that he showed up, and he was only 22. And we thought he was the youngest driver in the race until we find out that Jose Legarza had lopped 3 years off of his. But he was only 22 years old when he drove in his first race. And then in 1982, he didn't start, He dropped out late in 81. In fact, there's a little trivia there. He pulled off, and some people may remember this aesthetically pleasing scene down on the inside of Turn 1. Mike Mosley dropped out early and pulled over into the Turn 1 infield grass right next to the rail. And I'm trying to think who else there was. There was Tom Bigelow pulled off there, and then Scott Brayton pulled off. And he was the fourth person. I can't remember what the other one was, but they had four cars parallel parked down there. Anyway, 82, there was a problem in practice where he got burned with hot water poured down his back, and it ended up that he didn't run in the race. But every year thereafter, and the highlights were sixth in 89 and sixth in 93. And 89 was one that he could have come very close to winning, and I'd have to set up the whole thing, and it would take a little while to do that. He was on the front row in 85 and almost had the pole, except that there was a mechanical failure developing, and there's two different versions on exactly what happened. Well, when he came down to take the checker, although he had broken the one lap record that had just been set by Pancho Carter, the problem that he had coming down for the checker drug the last lap down, and so the average fell below Carter, and so he ended up in the middle of the front row. And then, of course, on the pole in 95, and then he won the pole again in 96. He never got to start the race, of course, because of the accident in practice, but the thing that was amongst the many things that made him really endearing was that he cared so much about the Speedway, more than most people, because he had pretty much of an encyclopedic knowledge about the goings-on, and I'll end with this one here, and that is that nobody had ever won three poles in a row, which was his ambition. But there were eight other drivers that had won it twice in a row, and he could name the eight, which was really amazing, because I don't know if anybody else could have done one, and he could do all of them. He just really cared about the history of the place.
How many years did Talk at Gasoline Alley originate out of his garage?
I can only remember the one, 1989, because Jonathan Bird did a deal with Dick Simon, and Scott Brayton was the driver. So I just think it was that 1 year, 89, and he got sixth.
Yeah. All right, Jim, thanks for the call. We do appreciate it. Donald, hang on. 6:49, we'll come right back. Let's take a look at Sky Traffic. Here's Big John Gillum. 6:53. The Talk of Gasoline Alley. Sports Talk's up next. Let's get back to the phones. Lots of questions here. Clark, you're on WIBC with Donald Davidson.
Hi, guys. Donald, I know the backup cars are called the T cars, but what's the significance or the origin of the T?
Okay. It depends on which country you're in. It actually comes from Europe, and it used to mean T for the training car. And when they would go to a difficult circuit, and sorry, but Grand Prix courses used to be a lot tougher than they are now. And so if you would go to a place like the Nürburgring, which was 14 and a half miles around and had 176 turns, and they took a new driver, they didn't want to wear out the good stuff, so they would take a third or fourth car, which was nicknamed the Mule, and it was also called the T-car, which meant training car. And it wasn't that the guy was learning how to drive, but he wanted to learn the course, and so they would send him out in that so that he wouldn't wear out the good stuff. So then when it was first used in this country, the first time I remember it being was McLaren, which is a European team. They used it for a different reason, and it was this, that the USAC or Speedway Management or whatever you want to call it, they like to have the cars painted up with the correct number. In other words, that the program number would be painted on the car. And they went through, it used to really not matter what the numbers were, but as sponsors came in, and there was tie-ins and posters and drivers stand up in the liquor store and all this kind of stuff, and they didn't want the stuff to be confusing. A team would qualify one of the other cars with a number other than what was associated with the team, and then make a request to change the number for the race, so that Foyt would always have 14 or whatever the number was that was associated with that team. And so rather than change the whole numbers, they came up with a T system because in fact, they even went to the T and the TT, so you could actually for a while have three cars with the same number on it, and then the T after, or the TT, to designate that it was a backup. If it was one of those that you qualified, then you would apply to have the number changed, and all you had to do is remove the T. And so T in Europe meant training, and T in this country meant temporary.
There you go.
And then I want to correct myself on something. Mm-hmm. As soon as we pitched the break, I said that we were with Scott Brayton in 1989. It was 1993 with Dick Simon, and a couple more comments on how he was interested in history. For years and years and years, I used to go down to Rushville, Indiana, to go to the Knights of Columbus there and go with a driver. And this one year I went down with Scott, and on the way he brought up the question. He's talked about the number of stats that he had. Now, I don't recall what year this would be, but it was about 93 or 94. It probably was 93 because of the association with us being in his garage. So anyway, on the way back, he said, well, I'm getting quite a few starts now. How many people have had more starts than me? And I said, well, it's funny you would bring that up because I said, you're part of a pretty good trivia question. And it had got to the point where Scott Brayton's kind of crapped up on you. Mario Andretti, I think it was Mario. Mario had the greatest number of starts. We're running out of time here, so I won't be able to finish the story. Well, anyway, it turned out that he was second. And I know that in 1994, we said that if Gary Bettenhausen doesn't qualify, who would have the second highest number of starts behind Mario? The answer was Scott Brayton. And he was very happy to know that. And then also, after, as soon as the 93 race was ended, it was Emerson Fittipaldi, Ari Leyendijk, Nigel Mansell, Raul Boissel, Mario Andretti, and then Scott was sixth. And I asked him after the race on the air, of the drivers, who was the highest finishing American-born driver? And he said, me. He'd already figured it out.
There you
go. Night, everybody.
Thanks, Donald. Great job, as always. Thanks for the call. If you didn't get in, try us again tomorrow night. Every night we're here, 6 to 7, to talk at Gasoline. Sports Talk's next. Thanks for listening. See everybody back here tomorrow.